Here, when he says not real, he does not just mean that the self cannot be found when sought from among or separate from the six constituents. Nagarjuna is making the point that although the mind realizing the emptiness of inherent existence sees a mere absence, that very mind promotes an understanding that the self is a dependent arising. I feel that the way he presents this is full of impact, avoiding both the extreme of holding that the self inherently exists and the extreme of holding that the self does not exist at all. Like the two signs of the hand, when looked at one way by examining its deeper nature, there is the emptiness of inherent existence. But when looked at from the other side, there is the appearance of the phenomenon itself. They are one entity. Therefore, form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. You have to be able to understand that the import of emptiness is also the meaning of dependent arising. They are deeply connected. As your insight into emptiness grows clearer, you will see more and more that objects depend on causes and conditions and depend on their parts, and they bring about pleasure and pain because they do not exist inherently. If you come to feel that everything is useless because it is empty, you are mistaking emptiness for nihilism. Properly understanding emptiness means realizing how we must rely on cause and effect. The natural and full understanding of emptiness means a profound understanding of the union of appearance and emptiness. The understanding of emptiness is fantastic, isn't it? It can serve as an antidote to the misconception of inherent existence, and yet in itself, it also assists in greater understanding of cause and effect. That is real understanding of emptiness. It is impossible to explain the import of the realization of emptiness in the context of just hearing or reading an explanation. It is something that has to be worked at over a long period of time, together with the practices of morality. These are to refrain from harm and to extend compassion, as explained earlier. It is also necessary to make supplications to Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and other teachers for help in overcoming obstacles. We need many positive causes. Summary for daily practice. Reflect frequently on how phenomena arise depending on causes and conditions, and try to see how this opposes the way phenomena and things appear to be so solidly existent, to exist in their own right, to exist inherently. If you tend toward nihilism, reflect more on dependent arising. If by concentrating on causes and conditions, you tend to reinforce the inherent existence of phenomena, then put more emphasis on how dependence contradicts this so solid appearance. You will probably be pulled from one side to the other. The true middle way takes time to find. Mind and the deep nature of mind. In the scripture on perfect wisdom, Buddha makes the following profound statement. In the mind is not to be found. The nature of the mind is clear light. To understand the levels of meaning in this statement, you have to first identify what the mind is. Then you need to analyze its deeper meaning. And finally, investigate how good and bad effects come about. Let us examine the various parts of the statement. The phrase, in the mind, is concerned with what mind is, its luminous and knowing nature. When we discussed concentrated meditation, we talked about the luminous and knowing nature of the mind and how, although it exists throughout every moment of mind, it is necessary to set aside previous thoughts and not begin new ones in order to identify it. When Buddha says, the mind is not to be found, this indicates that luminosity and knowing are not the mind's deepest and final nature. Rather, the ultimate nature of the mind is clear light, which here means its emptiness of inherent existence. You might think that Buddha is saying that the mind does not exist, but this is not the case. I, as the explainer, am explaining this statement through the workings of my own mind, and you, the listener, are hearing by the workings of your mind. We are always using the mind, and it is always right with us, but we do not know it well. Thus, even though it is difficult to identify the mind, it exists and is being analyzed as to whether it is its own deep nature. It is clear that the mind exists, but since it is not established as its own final nature and its own basic disposition, what is its mode of being? Its deep nature is a mere emptiness of its own inherent existence. This means that the faulty defilements that pollute the mind, such as ignorance, lust, and hatred, are temporary, on the surface, and therefore separable from the mind. Once these defilements are understood to be superficial and not in the mind's basic nature, we see that the deep nature of the mind is clear light, the emptiness of inherent existence. Buddhist commentators explain in different ways the famous statement, defilements are superficial, the nature of the mind is clear light. Still, this is not a matter of Buddha's saying something so vague that it could be interpreted in any way one wishes. Rather, it has many different explicit and implicit meanings. In highest yoga tantra, there are many ways of drawing meaning out of an abstruse statement. One can explain its literal meaning, its general meaning, its hidden meaning, and its final meaning. To clarify Buddha's statement, defilements are superficial, the nature of the mind is clear light, in combination with Tantra, I will cite the Magical Array Tantra, which is a section in the repetition of the names of Manjushri Tantra. The perfect Buddhas arise from A. A is the supreme of letters. From among the four meanings I just listed, I will give a general explanation of this statement. The letter A is a negative particle in Sanskrit. It indicates emptiness, which is the absence or negation of inherent existence. When the Magical Array Tantra says that the perfect Buddhas arise from A, this means that the Buddhas dawn from within the noumenal sphere of emptiness. Or, put another way, the Buddhas dawn from within meditating on the emptiness of inherent existence. Through meditation, defilements are extinguished in the noumenal sphere of reality, which is the emptiness of inherent existence. Emptiness, symbolized by A, is the supreme topic, and therefore, the Magical Array Tantra says, A is the supreme of letters. Also, from the viewpoint of highest yoga tantra, The letter A refers to the indestructible drop within which a Buddha body is achieved. In highest yoga tantra, Buddhahood arises by concentratedly focusing on the indestructible drop at the heart center. The final body of a Buddha has the nature of the indestructible drop. This adds to our understanding of the statement that the perfect Buddhas arise from the letter A. What is the indestructible drop? It is the union of the very subtle wind and the very subtle mind. Mind knows objects, whereas wind, or inner energy, causes consciousness to engage objects. Since this is the case, with a union of wind and mind, there are changes in consciousness. Consciousness is non-physical. It does not have a color or shape or the obstructive quality of physical things. Its entity is mere luminosity and cognition. And when it meets with certain conditions, such as when an object is present and a sense faculty is functioning properly, it reflects that object. That the mind changes from moment to moment and appears in different aspects indicates that the mind operates under the influence of causes and conditions. A mind arises in dependence upon a former mind of similar type, which requires that there has been an earlier, beginningless continuum of mind. If the production of a mind did not need to depend upon former moments of mind, but could just be produced causelessly, then a mind could be produced anywhere and anytime, which is absurd. Similarly, if consciousness was not produced as a continuation of a former entity of consciousness, and instead were produced from something physical, either it would always, absurdly, be produced, or it would never be produced, which is also absurd. This indicates that consciousness is a continuation of a former entity of consciousness. Because consciousness is based in a former moment of consciousness, there can be no beginning to its continuum. There is no beginning of consciousness, and there is no end to it. This continuum makes possible the transformation of the mind into improved states. When the mental continuum is associated with impure states, our experience is limited to the realm of cyclic existence. When the mental continuum breaks free from impure states, we can achieve nirvana. In this way, all phenomena are the artifice or the sport of the mind. The impure phenomena of cyclic existence are the sport of impure mind. The pure phenomena of nirvana are the sport of pure mind. Since it is said that in the mind is not to be found, the nature of the mind is clear light, impure states, such as lust and hatred, are not part of the nature of mind, but must be produced by ignorance, a consciousness misconceiving inherent existence, either in the present moment or from an earlier source. All faulty states of mind have mistaken consciousness as their root. Ignorance is a form of consciousness that is mistaken about the object of its attention. It is wrong about it. It has no valid cognition as its root. A mistaken consciousness and an awareness with a valid foundation have contradictory ways of apprehending phenomena, so the one harms the other. When, in your practice, you become accustomed to correct attitudes, faulty states of mind naturally diminish until finally they are extinguished. The very system of the Buddhist teaching is based on natural contradiction. We want happiness and do not want suffering. The pain we seek to avoid mainly stems from mental attitudes. And since the source of mental suffering is afflictive emotions, either directly or indirectly, we have to consider whether there are any forces opposing them. If, for instance, anger causes suffering, then we must find a contradictory force. For anger, it is love and compassion. Although anger and love and compassion are all consciousnesses, they have contradictory ways of apprehending the same object. Their realizations are opposites. Similarly, if a room is too hot, there is no way to reduce the heat but to introduce cold. Just as heat and cold oppose each other, so too do opposing mental states, pure and impure. To the extent you develop one, the other decreases. Therefore, it is possible to remove faulty states of mind. Antidotes exist. The mind itself is a conventional truth. The reality of the mind, its emptiness of inherent existence, is its ultimate truth. These two truths are contained in one indivisible entity. Just as there is a union of the two truths, conventional and ultimate, with respect to the mind, so there is a union of the two truths with respect to each and every object. Its appearance is a conventional truth, and its emptiness of inherent existence is its ultimate truth. Final reality is known through the reasoning of dependent arising. For instance, because the mind is a dependently arisen entity, the mind is empty of existing from its own side. When you understand emptiness through the reasoning of dependent arising, you realize that all phenomena are unions of dependent arising and emptiness. Appearance and emptiness are perceived as harmonious. Dependently arisen appearances of conventional phenomena provide the context for teaching compassion, which is called the vast path, as there is such a huge variety of appearances. The emptiness of the inherent existence of appearances provides the basis for teaching what is known as the profound path, because emptiness is the final nature of phenomena, peaceful, free from conceptualizations, and of one taste. Through meditatively cultivating these two paths, the vast aspect of compassion and the profound wisdom of emptiness in an inseparable way, faulty states of mind in your continuum undergo gradual transformation. They are gradually removed, and the excellent attributes of a Buddha's mind and body emerge. Buddhahood is achieved through the unified cultivation of both motivation and wisdom. However, motivation and wisdom have their own respective imprints on Buddhahood. The result of cultivating motivation is the form bodies of a Buddha, which exists for the sake of fulfilling the well-being of others. The imprint of cultivating wisdom is the truth body of a Buddha, which is the fulfillment of your own development. What are the main forms of motivation and wisdom? The primary motivation is an other-directed intention to become enlightened, inspired by love and compassion, and inspiring the practice of compassionate deeds such as giving, morality, and patience. The main form of wisdom is an intelligent consciousness realizing the emptiness of inherent existence. The foundations of Buddhism have three aspects: The basis is the two truths, conventional and ultimate. From these two truths, the path emerges with the twin factors of motivation and wisdom, each related to its respective truth. The fruit or result of travel on the path is actualization of the two bodies, the form bodies and the truth body of a Buddha. To bring this all together, on the basis of the two truths, which are the conventional and ultimate truths, you practice the two qualities of the path, motivation and wisdom. These lead you to achieve the fruit, the form and truth bodies of a Buddha. Summary for daily practice. First of all, identify the luminous and knowing nature of the mind, unclouded by thoughts. Then, probe the deeper nature of the mind again and again to reveal its absence of inherent existence, its emptiness. Do this by reflecting on the mind's dependence on causes and conditions. Also, reflect on the mind's dependence on its parts. This means that any length of time that passes in the mind depends on earlier and later parts of that time period, beginning, middle, and end. Finally, try to realize the compatibility of the appearance of the mind with its emptiness of inherent existence. See how these two mutually support each other. Part 5. Tantra. In Buddhism, there are basically two types of practices, sutra and tantra. So far, we have been discussing sutra practice. The special purpose of tantra is to provide a faster path so that qualified practitioners can be of service to others more quickly. In Tantra, the power of imagination is harnessed to meditation in a practice called Deity Yoga. Deity Yoga is in three phases. 1. Replace your mind as it ordinarily appears, full of troubling emotions, with a mind of pure wisdom, motivated by compassion. 2. Substitute your body as it ordinarily appears, composed of flesh, blood, and bone, with a body fashioned from compassionately motivated wisdom. 3. Develop a sense of a pure self that depends upon purely appearing mind and body in an ideal environment, fully engaged in helping others. As this distinctive practice of Tantra calls for visualizing yourself with the Buddha's body, activities, resources, and surroundings, it is called taking imagination as the spiritual path. Let us consider a qualm about this practice. You are considering yourself to have Buddha qualities which you presently do not have. Is this, then, a correct type of meditative consciousness? Yes. Your mind is involved in understanding reality out of which you are appearing as a deity. Therefore, your mind, from this viewpoint, is correct. Also, you are purposely imagining yourself as having a divine body, even if you do not presently possess one. This is an imaginative meditation. You are not convinced from the depths that you actually have pure mind, body, and selfhood. Rather, based in clear imagination of ideal body and mind, you are cultivating the sense of being a deity, compassionately helping others. To be a special trainee of Tantra, that is to say, the kind of trainee for whom Buddha specifically set forth the practice of Tantra, a practitioner must have sharp faculties and have already attained stable wisdom realizing emptiness, or be ready for speedy activation of this wisdom. The requirements for just practicing Tantra are less rigorous. Still, to engage in Tantra at any level demands a powerful intention to become enlightened for the sake of others, and a feeling that this needs to be done very quickly. At the beginning of tantric practice, the basic way to develop calm abiding is to meditate on your own body as if it were that of a deity. When you meditate on a divine body, first you meditate on emptiness, gaining as much awareness of the emptiness of inherent existence as you can. When you have acclimated to this state, you use that very mind itself as the basis out of which the deity appears. The mind realizing emptiness appears as the deity and as his or her surroundings. First you meditate on emptiness. Out of that the deity appears, then you concentrate on the deity. In this way, deity yoga combines wisdom and compassionate motivation. A single consciousness realizes emptiness and also appears compassionately in the form of an altruistic deity. In the sutra system, although there is a union of wisdom and compassionate motivation, the practice of wisdom is only affected by the force of the practice of motivation, and the practice of motivation is only affected by the force of the practice of wisdom. They are not contained within one consciousness. A distinguishing feature of Tantra is that they are contained in one consciousness. Inclusion of motivation and wisdom within one consciousness is what makes Tantra's progress so swift. When I was a young boy, Tantra was just a matter of blind faith. At age 24, I lost my own country, and then after coming to India, started really reading Tsongkhapa's explanations on emptiness. Then, after moving to Dharamsala, I put more effort into the study and practice of the stages of the path, emptiness, and Tantra. So it was only in my late 20s, after gaining some experience of emptiness, that deity yoga made sense. One time, in the main temple in Dharamsala, I was performing the ritual of imagining myself as a deity of highest yoga tantra called Guhya Samaja. My mind continuously remained on the recitation of the ritual text, and when the words "I myself" came, I completely forgot about my usual self in relation to my combination of mind and body. Instead, I had a very clear sense of I in relation to the new, pure combination of mind and body of Guhya Samaja that I was imagining. Since this is the type of self-identification that is at the heart of tantric yoga, the experience confirmed for me that with enough time, I could definitely achieve the extraordinary deep states mentioned in the scriptures. To practice Tantra, it is especially important to gain access to the transmission of blessings from previous great beings. Blessings also exist in sutra practice, but they are crucial in Tantra. The initial means of entry to these blessings is through the door of initiation. There are four classes of tantras: action, performance, yoga, and highest yoga tantra, each with its own initiations to ripen the mind for practice, and each with its own meditations. Where do you receive initiation? In a mandala, comprised of ideal surroundings and divine residence, which are all manifestations of compassion and wisdom. There are mandalas of varying complexity for all four tantras. Some are painted, others are constructed from colored sands, and still others comprise a special class of concentration mandalas. In order to receive initiation and to take vows in a mandala of Yoga Tantra or highest Yoga Tantra, the Lama conducting the ceremony must have the full complement of qualifications. All four sets of tantras place special emphasis on the attributes of the Lama, in keeping with Buddha's detailed descriptions of teachers' qualifications for the various stages of the path. Remember also Buddha's admonition mentioned earlier to rely not just on the person, but on the doctrine. You should not be overwhelmed by a teacher's reputation. Most importantly, the teacher must know the doctrine, the practices, well. In the two lower tantra sets, action and performance, there is no clear indication that tantric vows must be taken upon initiation. Nevertheless, there are many pledges to be kept. In the two higher tantra sets, yoga and highest yoga, after receiving initiation with all of its facets, you must take tantric vows in addition to the pledges. Yoga Tantra and Highest Yoga Tantra have 14 basic vows, as well as lists of infractions to guard against. They differ in their respective paths, and therefore even the basic vows differ slightly. The practice of Tantra is mainly concerned with overcoming the appearance of yourself and your surroundings as ordinary. The aim of this is to overcome the conception of these as ordinary. Therefore, you first visualize yourself to have a Buddha's body, compassionate activities, resources, and abode. Hence, most of the pledges are concerned with substituting ideal for ordinary appearances. This imaginary substitution helps in restraining your own estimation of yourself, your companions, your environment, and your activities as being ordinary. Except for the particular vow of individual liberation that lasts just for 24 hours, all of the other vows of individual liberation are taken for an entire lifetime, although it is possible to rescind one's vows and give back one's ordination. By contrast, Bodhisattva and Tantric vows extend right through to the time of highest enlightenment, as long as one has not committed a root infraction. First, one assumes the morality of individual liberation. Then, one assumes Bodhisattva morality. And finally, Tantric morality. Householders who take the Bodhisattva and Tantric vows keep a householder's version of the vows of individual liberation. The Kalachakra Tantra, which flourished during the 11th century in India and became a principal tantra of the new translation schools in Tibet, states that if there are three teachers of tantra, one with householder's vows, another with the vows of a novice monastic, and a third with the vows of a full-fledged monastic, the person who has taken the vows of a full-fledged monastic should be considered higher than the others. This indicates the high estimation that even this tantric system places on the monastic morality. The Guhya Samaja Tantra similarly says that externally you should keep the discipline of the practice of individual liberation and internally maintain an affinity for the practice of tantra. In these ways, the practice of sutra and tantra work together. In the practice of tantra, it is possible to use sexual desire in the path. Let us begin to consider the role of sexual desire in the path in tantra by looking at the prohibition against sexual misconduct in the morality of individual liberation, which is entirely based on the principle of refraining from harming others. Specific sexual misconduct is identified in detail in Vasubandhu's Treasury of Manifest Knowledge. For a male, it would be to cohabit with someone else's wife, or with someone who is under the care of her family. For a female, it is the same. It is prohibited to cohabit with someone else's husband, or with someone who is under the care of his family. Some have suggested ridiculously that since Vasubandhu's text explains the 10 non-virtues from the viewpoint of a male, there is no fault if a female engages in the non-virtues, and thus there are no prohibitions for a female. This is ridiculous. For Buddhists, sexual intercourse can be used in the spiritual path because it causes a strong focusing of consciousness if the practitioner has firm compassion and wisdom. Its purpose is to manifest and prolong the deeper levels of mind, which I described earlier with respect to the process of dying. The aim is to put their power to use in strengthening the realization of emptiness. Otherwise, mere intercourse has nothing to do with spiritual cultivation. When a person has achieved a high level of practice in motivation and wisdom, then even the joining of the two sex organs, or so-called intercourse, does not detract from the maintenance of that person's pure behavior. Yogis who have achieved a high level of the path and are fully qualified can engage in sexual activity, and a monastic with this ability can maintain all the precepts. One Tibetan yogi adept, when criticized by another, said that he ate meat and drank beer as offerings to the mandala deity. Such tantric practitioners visualize themselves as deities in a complete mandala, within realization that the ultimate deity is the ultimate bliss, the union of bliss and emptiness, a bliss consciousness realizing emptiness. He also said that his sexual practice with a consort was undertaken for the sake of developing real knowledge, and that indeed is the purpose. Such a practitioner can make spiritual use not only of delicious meat and drink, but even of human excrement and urine. A yogi's meditation transforms these into real ambrosia. For people like us, however, this is beyond our reach. As long as you can't transform piss and shit, these other things should not be done. Buddha set out a specific series of stages on the path precisely for this reason. The preliminary stage is training in the vows of individual liberation. If you live as a monk or nun, your conduct has a more sound basis. There is little danger of excessive distraction. Even if you cannot fully implement such vows, there is not much risk. Then, simply practice, practice, practice. Once you develop inner strength, you can control the four internal elements, earth, water, fire, and wind, or five elements if inner space is included. Once you can fully control these internal elements, then you can control the outer five elements. Then you can make use of anything. How does sexual intercourse help in the path? There are many different levels of consciousness. The potential of grosser levels is very limited, but the deeper, more subtle levels are much more powerful. We need to access these subtler levels of mind. But in order to do so, we need to weaken and temporarily stop grosser consciousness. To accomplish this, it is necessary to bring about dramatic changes in the flow of inner energies. Even though brief versions of the deeper levels of mind occur during sneezing and yawning, these obviously cannot be prolonged. Also, previous experience with manifesting the deeper levels is required to make use of their occurrence in deep sleep. This is where sex comes in. Through special techniques of concentration during sex, competent practitioners can prolong very deep, subtle, and powerful states and put them to use to realize emptiness. However, if you engage in sexual intercourse within an ordinary mental context, there is no benefit. A Buddha has no use for sexual intercourse. Deities depicted in a mandala are often in union with a consort, but this does not suggest that Buddhas have to rely on sexual intercourse for their bliss. Buddhas have full bliss within themselves. Deities spontaneously appear in mandalas in male-female union for the benefit of people with very sharp faculties who can make use of a consort and the bliss of sexual union in practicing the quick path of Tantra. In much the same way, the Tantric Buddha Vajradhara appears in peaceful aspects and wrathful aspects. But this does not mean that Vajradhara has these two aspects to his personality. Vajradhara is always totally compassionate. Rather, his spontaneous appearance in various ways is for the sake of trainees. Vajradhara appears in just the way that the trainee should meditate when using afflictive emotions such as lust or hatred in the process of the path. To corral such powerful emotions into the spiritual path, trainees cannot be imagining that they have the peaceful body of Shakyamuni Buddha. Deity yoga is required. Since in the case of hatred, for instance, it is necessary to meditate on your own body in a fierce form, Vajradhara automatically appears in the appropriate ferocious form to show the trainee how to meditate. The same is true for sexual yoga. Trainees who are capable of using the bliss arising from the desire involved in gazing, smiling, holding hands, or union must perform the appropriate deity yoga. They could not be imagining themselves as Shakyamuni, a monk. The purpose of Vajradhara's various appearances is neither to scare the trainees nor to excite desire in them, but to show how to do imaginative meditation in those forms in order eventually to overcome afflictive emotions. A Buddha is capable of appearing spontaneously without exertion in whatever way is appropriate. The form of these appearances is shaped by the needs of others, not for the sake of that Buddha. From a Buddha's own point of view, that Buddha has the total self-fulfillment of the truth body, in which he or she remains forever. Remember that tantric morality is built on the morality of individual liberation and on the morality of compassion. The aim of Tantra is to achieve Buddhahood on a faster path in order to be of service to others more quickly. Summary for daily practice. Since the practice of Tantra is primarily to transform how you see yourself, others, the environment, and your activities, it can be helpful to visualize yourself as having a compassionate motivation, a pure body, and conduct that benefits others. Part 6. Steps along the way. Overview of the path to enlightenment. How does a practitioner gradually proceed to Buddhahood through meditatively cultivating the paths of motivation and wisdom? In the Heart Sutra, Buddha expresses the levels of the path in a short, profound statement. Tadyata, gatte gatte para gatte para sangatte bodhi swaha, which means, it is thus, proceed, proceed, proceed beyond, thoroughly proceed beyond, be founded in enlightenment. Let us examine this more closely, starting with the first word, gatte, proceed or go. Who is proceeding? It is the I or self that is designated depending upon the continuum of the mind. From what are you proceeding? You are moving away from cyclic existence, that state of being under the influence of contaminated actions and counterproductive emotions. To what are you proceeding? You are proceeding to Buddhahood, endowed with a truth body, forever free of suffering and the sources of suffering, these being the afflictive emotions, as well as free from the predispositions established by afflictive emotions. Upon what causes and conditions do you depend as you proceed? You are proceeding depending on a path that is a union of compassion and wisdom. Buddha is telling trainees to go to the other shore. From the viewpoint of the trainee, cyclic existence is on the near side. It is close at hand. On the far shore, a distant place, is nirvana, the state of having passed beyond suffering. When Buddha says, Tadyate, gatte gatte para gatte para sangatte bodhi swaha, it is thus, proceed, proceed, proceed beyond, thoroughly proceed beyond, be founded in enlightenment, he is telling trainees to proceed over the five paths. Gatte means the path of accumulation. The second gatte means the path of preparation. Paragatte is the path of seeing. Parasangatte is the path of meditation. And Bodhi is the path of no more learning. Let us identify the nature of spiritual advancement over these five paths. What is the initial path? The path of accumulation. It is that period when you mainly practice other-directed motivation and thereby accumulate great stores of merit. Also, although you are practicing a union of motivation and wisdom, your realization of emptiness has not reached the level of mutually supportive, stabilizing meditation and analytical meditation called a state arisen from meditation. On this path, you achieve powerfully concentrated meditation, and you are working toward a state arisen from meditation, realizing emptiness. At the point at which you achieve a state of wisdom arisen from meditation, realizing emptiness, you pass to the path of preparation. By becoming more and more familiar with this state, together with cultivating compassionate motivation, you gradually perceive the appearance of emptiness more clearly over the four levels of the path of preparation, which are called heat, peak, forbearance, and highest mundane qualities. Eventually, emptiness is realized directly, without even subtle contamination from dualistic appearance, which has vanished. This is the beginning of the path of seeing, which is the path of initial direct realization of the truth concerning the deep nature of phenomena. At this point in the Great Vehicle, the 10 Bodhisattva levels, which are called grounds because on them special spiritual qualities are engendered, begin. During the path of seeing and the path of meditation, two types of obstructions, intellectually acquired and innate, are respectively overcome. Intellectually acquired states of mind come about through adherence to false systems. For example, there are followers of some Buddhist schools who believe that phenomena conventionally exist by way of their own character. They base this on the unfounded reasoning that if phenomena were not established in this way, they could not function. This kind of misconception, polluted by an invalid system of tenets, is called artificial or intellectually acquired. Even if you have acquired no new predispositions through wrong conceptual thinking in this lifetime, everyone has, in their mental continuum, predispositions established by adhering to wrong views in former lifetimes. By contrast, innate faulty states of mind have existed in all sentient beings, from insects to humans, since beginningless time, and operate of their own accord without depending on faulty scripture and reasoning. Intellectually acquired or artificial obstructions are removed through the path of seeing, whereas innate obstructions are more difficult to overcome because you have been conditioned to these faulty states of mind since beginningless time. They must be removed by continued meditation on the meaning of emptiness. Because such meditation must take place repeatedly over a long period of time, this phase of the path is called the path of meditation. Indeed, you have meditated on emptiness earlier, but the path of meditation refers to a path of extended familiarization. On this level, you pass through the remaining 9 Bodhisattva grounds. From among the 10 grounds, the first 7 are called impure, and the last 3 are called pure. This is because on the first 7 grounds, you are still in process of removing afflictive obstructions, and thus these 7 are not yet purified of them. Through the first part of the 8th ground, you are removing afflictive emotions. The balance of the 8th, 9th, and 10th grounds enable you to overcome the obstructions to omniscience. Now, through using the diamond-like concentrated meditation achieved at the end of the 10 Bodhisattva grounds, the culmination of still having obstructions yet to be overcome, you can effectively undermine the very subtle obstructions to omniscience. The very next moment of your mind becomes an omniscient consciousness, and simultaneously, the deep nature of the mind becomes the nature body of a Buddha. This is the 5th and final path, the path of no more learning. From the very subtle wind or energy, which is one entity with that mind, various pure and impure physical forms spontaneously spring forth to assist sentient beings. These are called the form bodies of a Buddha. This is Buddhahood, a state of being a source of help and happiness for all sentient beings. Let me take a moment here to address the many misconceptions about whether or not women can attain Buddhahood. In the Sutra Great Vehicle, there is no indication that a woman cannot achieve Buddhahood. However, the texts state that during the practices for accumulating merit over three periods of countless great eons, you will arrive at a time when the karma you are working at will mature as the physical marks and beauties of a Buddha. At this time, according to the Sutra Great Vehicle, it helps to have a stronger physical support, so you naturally come to have the body of a male. Those texts also say that in the final lifetime, before you achieve Buddhahood, you need to have the body of a male. However, highest Yoga Tantra, which we consider to be the final system, says that not only can a woman achieve Buddhahood, but she can do so right in this lifetime. In all forms of Buddhism, practice is based on the intention to leave cyclic existence. Additionally, in the Great Vehicle, you are motivated by the other concerned intention to become enlightened. In Tantra, through techniques that enhance the development of the concentrated meditation, which is the union of calm abiding and special insight, you can achieve the state of Buddhahood in which all obstructions, the afflictive obstructions preventing liberation from cyclic existence, and the obstructions to omniscience preventing Buddhahood, have been removed. A Buddha's qualities are described as different bodies, which can be divided into general types: the truth body, for the fulfillment of your own welfare, and the form bodies, for the fulfillment of others' welfare. Form bodies, in turn, can be divided by how they appear to beings on different levels of purity and impurity. Highly advanced trainees can access what is called the complete enjoyment body. Other levels of trainees experience a wide variety of emanation bodies. The truth body can also be divided into two types, the nature body and the exalted wisdom body. The nature body can be further subdivided into a state of natural purification and a state of purification of adventitious or caused defilements. The exalted wisdom truth body can be further divided according to many different viewpoints. Maitreya's Ornament for Clear Realization specifies 21 sets of uncontaminated exalted wisdoms, which can be subdivided into 146 sets. This has been a brief explanation of 1. The ground, the two truths, conventional and ultimate. 2. The paths built on that ground, motivation and wisdom. 3. The fruits of the paths, the form bodies and the truth body of a Buddha. It is helpful to have this overview of the structure of practice. But you need to remember that realization is generated through many causes and conditions: proper understanding, accumulation of merit, and overcoming of obstructions. If you have not first accumulated merit and purified ill deeds, it is difficult to gain realization just from trying to meditate. Therefore, it is important to work through each of the prerequisites. Engagement in the prerequisites is not just a matter of filling some sort of count, or even of completing retreat for 3 years and three phases of the moon, as some might imagine from the fact that many retreats take this long, or for any other period of time. Instead, you must accumulate merit and purify obstructions until certain realizations are generated. You may spend your entire lifetime doing so, with the goal of improving future lives.